The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hello again. Today we'll be choosing our picks from the shows over the last year. We've talked to established celebrities, emerging talents, players and thinkers. But one thing we specially love about making these programmes is the chance to get out of the office and meet authors in their very own spaces.
Yes, the best thing is if you can bear to say hello to me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a dog whose bark is clearly worse than its bite. They do say that dogs take after their owners, and of course this one belongs to Will Self, whose voice you'll probably recognise there. Richard Lee entered fearlessly into the spirit by lying Will on his very own couch and casting himself as psychiatrist dealing with a somewhat unusual patient.
So, Mr. Self, or can I call you Will?
I welcome the deference, but yes.
That's very kind of you. Are you comfortable there on your couch?
It's not the ottoman I'm used to, but it'll do. It came from World of Sofas.
Can we start with this book you've written, which appears to be a sort of diary of three recent episodes? Can I begin by asking where the idea came from to turn away from fiction and to examine your own experiences in writing?
I can't remember who it was who said that all writers are either voyeurs or egotists. I think inevitably for writers in middle age there is a sense that the observed life is over-observed and there's nothing much happening in it, and therefore ineluctably the idea arises that one should as it were write about the observing of the life in that way. So it's a kind of recursion in that sense.
This wasn't the idea of one of your therapists?
My therapists have tolerated rather than encouraged my work over the years. There's been a degree of confabulation. Zach Busner, who, you know, I've been in therapy with on and off since my late teens, has appeared in a number of my books as a character. I've appeared in a number of his articles in the British Journal of Ephemera, normally, you know, in his investigations and papers on schizophreniform disorders of one kind or another.
It's a very grim vision. It's sometimes almost horrific. Do you think it's part of the writer's job to hold up a mirror to society and reflect the shitness of the world?
What we call the crap force, in fact, which, as Schopenhauer observed, is almost in opposition to the life force. I don't know what the writer's job is. I suspect that these memoirs, these peripatetic memoirs, come rather out of the fact that writers don't have a job, in fact, and therefore are compelled to anatomise themselves.
And the book Will was talking about is Walking to Hollywood, published by Bloomsbury. Of course, I've shared this year with our book's website editor, Sarah Crown, and we've had all sorts of people on the show, haven't we, Sarah?
Yes, we've had everyone from poets and pundits to potters, which I think we'll come to a bit later on. And we've also preempted some of the year's big prizes. We interviewed most of the Booker longlist, for instance.
And Sarah, you actually spotted the Crime Writers Association's Golden Dagger winner, Belinda Bauer. I mentioned this one because I really admire you for this. It was a first novel out in January, and only this autumn she went on to become the first Lady of Crime with her first novel, Blackland. So congratulations.
Thanks very much. It was a proud moment. It's a very, very good book. It's really stayed with me, actually. Very sort of bleak and disturbing. And we do, of course, get the occasional celebrity as well as straight-up authors such as Simon Callow, who came in to talk to you, Claire, about his new memoir, My Life in Pieces.
Now, I have to come out immediately and say this book's a bit of a cheat because it's actually compiled of pieces you've written before.
Yes, except that at least half of it is new. Because in trying to put together all these pieces in some sort of coherent order, I decided to tell the events as they happened rather than the order in which I wrote them. And so I've written a lot of connective tissue, which in fact tells what was inevitably what was going on in my life. And I found that rather hard to write, actually. I mean, hard in two senses. One, it was quite hard to actually get the narrative clear, but also it involved me digging into some memories that I'd rather sort of put out of my mind. And, you know, it's a story of a person's working life. And whatever we all claim about longing to, you know, stop work and lounge around. Actually, that probably is the centre for many of us, or a very crucial centre of most of our lives. So it's very unexpectedly personal, I found. I found, in a sense, how much my work matters to me.
Mm. You call it an alternative autobiography.
Yeah.
You mentioned there an anecdote about appearing in pantomime. Tell us a bit about some of the people that you've worked with.
I was incredibly lucky. Very quickly went from my very first job, in which I was on the sort of sprawling on the steps of the Assembly Hall in Edinburgh, crying "Aye" and "No," and playing the front end of a horse in Büchner's Woyzeck, to being in the West End within 2 years. Harry Secombe had seen me in a play and bought the play, and there we were on stage together, and I literally sort of had my name in lights. And from then on, I kept alternating between doing extreme fringe work and very sort of glamorous West End work, and often coming across some of the great celebrities of my time.
You worked with Olivier and Gielgud,
right,
and everyone like that.
My very, very first job in the theatre was working in the box office of the National Theatre when Laurence Olivier was running it, and indeed I'd got the job from writing a letter to Sir Laurence, and he'd said, if you like it so much here, why don't you come and work here? And so I worked in the box office, and then I did get to know the young lions of that time, like Michael Gambon and Derek Jacobi and Anthony Hopkins, who were playing those younger parts, and also people like Sir Laurence and Maggie Smith and Joan Plowright at the top. And then in my own career, I went to work at the National Theatre. I played in Amadeus with Paul Scofield, than whom, in my view, has been no greater actor in the 20th century. I'd grown up on these great actors anyway as a member of the audience. Gielgud, Richardson, Ashcroft, Donald Wolfit, Michael Redgrave, these were the people we saw all the time, and they made a huge impact on me. And I didn't realise it at the time, I suppose none of us did, but they were in fact the end of a tradition, a particular kind of tradition of what I call thespocentric theatre which revolved absolutely round the actors. And so I have spent quite a lot of my writing life writing about these people to remind people that they existed and to offer them as inspiration. The circumstances which gave rise to these actors have gone. We'll never again have anyone like Laurence Olivier, in my view.
I think it's David Hare called you the great unofficial archivist of the theatre. Now, some of these people are not very nice. I was particularly taken with some of your John Dexter anecdotes. Tell us a little bit about John Dexter.
Well, John was a sort of a thug in art. He was a bully. A terrible bully as a director. He was a very wounded, very damaged man. That was very evident. And because it was so evident, in a sort of a way, one forgave him, unless one happened to be on the receiving end, which I never was, thank God. He was very nice, even sweet to me. But he could be an absolute brute. He picked on people. Famously, he'd have a whipping boy in the company. I remember
Peter Schaffer once was a whipping boy during Amadeus when you were working on that.
Well, John didn't direct Amadeus, but when John directed Equus
and
other Peter Schaffer plays, he had nicknames for everybody. He called Peter Schaffer Ruby. I have no idea why, nor did Peter Schaffer know. And eventually, after being taunted about Ruby this and Ruby that, Peter said to him, "Oh, shut up, Rose." And John said, "Rose?" And he said, "Yes, as in Rose, thou art sick."
Simon Callow there. My Life in Pieces is published by Nick Hearn. It's of course been a year of much important international news, some of which we've covered in our podcasts.
Yes, we had back in the springtime, we had the volcanic ash cloud, which wiped out much of the London Book Fair. And we took advantage of that to interview Simon Winchester about his book Krakatoa, in which he talks about the eruption of that volcano. Then we had the election and its aftermath, and we talked to political commentators Will Hutton and Polly Toynbee about their prescriptions for the future of British politics. And then finally, we had escalating drug wars in Mexico, and we were lucky enough to have Ed Vuliami and the Colombian historian Oscar Guardiola Rivera on hand to discuss them with us.
Yeah, it just goes to show that wherever there's a world event, there's a book that is there as well to offer intelligent insight on it. But the literary world's also created its own newsbreakers, and none bigger than the staggering international success of the Millennium Trilogy by the Swedish author Stieg Larsson, which became the biggest seller worldwide since Harry Potter. Sarah, is this really true? I keep hearing this, and I can't quite believe it.
Apparently it is true, yes. Again, it seems sort of startling. And the really sad thing about it, of course, is that Larson died age 50 before his books took off, so he never knew anything about it. And now there's this very well-publicised dispute over his will between his birth family and his partner of 30 years, Eva Gabrielsen. And the Observer's New Review earlier this year carried an interview with Gabrielsen, who claims that the work has been prettified in translation. And Claire, you put that to Observer literary editor Will Skidelsky and our very own Larson groupie Rosie Swash.
There's evidence in the title change. The title of the first book in the trilogy is The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and the original title in Swedish was Men Who Hate Women, which I always see a little bit less marketable, although I probably still would have read it. And I think that's probably what she's talking about, is he had a very clear agenda. It's subtle in the books, I feel, in that he wanted to explore violence against women, institutionalised sexism. And it's interesting, considering the legacy since his death and what's happened to Gabrielsen, that his message was always women should fight back. And I guess that's what she's trying to do. She's trying to fight back and say, I was there with him when he wrote these books. This isn't how he would have wanted them to be portrayed, particularly with something like the title, because The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo totally put me off as a title. I did not want to read it. I just thought, that sounds awful.
Now, Rachel Cook is quite sceptical about the books. She says, among other things, the first book, which is also the best of the three, has the most boring opening 50 pages of any crime novel ever written.
True.
Do you agree with this?
Yeah, 100% agree. I started reading it about a year ago, and I just thought, what is this? It's really corporate. It's about this family that I guess are the Scandinavian equivalent of the Murdochs, and one of the pages is dedicated to a family tree. And obviously also because all the names are Swedish, you just think, oh, it's so impenetrable. So there's definitely a point that you have to get to where it becomes gripping, but he's very, very deep. Detailed writer. There's lots of things that happen in the book that you're waiting to know why they're there. Why is it? And it's got no relevance to the central plot. And he really likes to give his characters a lot of layers. But I really enjoy his writing style. It's very clean, probably because he was a journalist and then became a fiction writer. So it's not, he hasn't got a sort of flowery prose style.
Although rather amusingly in the piece that all these sort of aspersions cast even on his writing, and lots of people say he was such a terrible writer. You know, as a journalist, his copy needed so much editing that he can't have written these books. You know, it must have.
Well, some people are insinuating that Gabrielsen must have. Yeah, she had a role. Yeah, so I don't know, but they're still good. They're still good.
There's also a suggestion that there are 200 pages of an unfinished manuscript sitting somewhere, maybe
she's holding on to them
in his computer, which he's holding,
and the family want the computer.
Custody of his computer.
It's that's a new one.
And apparently they said, we'll give you, you know, his apartment if you hand over the computer. Yeah, although she hasn't now got the apartment.
The Millennium Trilogy, of course, was a triumph as well for small publishing this year. It's out from McElhose Books, and we always like to hear about those, don't we, Sarah? But while fiction always does have its bestsellers, it's celebrity memoirs that usually hit the end-of-year jackpot. Michael McIntyre and Stephen Fry are currently slugging it out at the top of the non-fiction charts. They're both comedians, so why is it that we love comedy in our non-fiction but not so much in our novels? Or actually, is this true, Sarah?
Well, a lot's been said about it this year. It's been a big debate, largely led by Howard Jacobson, who has always had a bee in his bonnet about not getting the plaudits he deserved, and mainly because he thinks that we don't reward funny fiction in this country. But then, of course, he went on to win the Booker this year with the Finkley Question, which we were absolutely thrilled about on the podcast.
Yeah, and before it went on to do that, it was shortlisted for the Woodhouse Prize for Comic Writing. So we asked him in to discuss it with the critic Alex Clark. And one pretty surprising inclusion this year was Ian McEwan's Solar, which is all about global warming. Hardly a laughing matter, surely.
Well, I suppose if it were about that, it might not be funny, but it's about other things that are funny, like, you know, adult male rivalry, sexual desire, academic pretension and competition.
Mm, which makes it sound like a campus novel, really.
I think it is in some ways. There's an element of that.
Yeah, and that's a big area for comedy. David Lodge, the likes of him.
Yes, there's part of that meets something else. I'm not quite sure. Yeah.
But Howard, do you think it's important to have a prize that honours comic writing?
This is a tough one, this, because I'm never sure about prizes altogether. Mm. One, you feel ambiguously about prizes. And there's something a little bit awkward to my sense about isolating comedy and giving a prize for that. Which said, I was very pleased to have won it. B, every year I am extremely interested to see who's coming up for it. And this would not have to happen had there not been a perception on the part of those who did that the novels that seemed to be rewarded most in prizes and things weren't funny at all. So there was a feeling around that there was a grudging attitude to comedy. But I don't myself see it as a separate genre.
So why do you think that is then, that as a nation we tend to be a bit sneery about comedy, about comic writing?
If you go by prizes, most prizes are chosen by committee. Mm. Comedy is by its nature divisive. Mm. Comedy is, the whole point of it is it will upset people and make people uncomfortable. So the chance of your making, you know, at least half that panel too uncomfortable to bear you is high. Mm. On top of that, literature has grown very sanctimonious in our times. I mean, it has been argued that where the church left off, literature took over. And if it's any good, of course, it's not the opposite to, this has to be said from the start, it is not the opposite to serious. For me, the most serious things will always have comedy in them. The great books for me are books which I wouldn't say are comic books, but they are books which have comedy somewhere near the centre of them. And if a book doesn't have comedy near the centre of it, it's not a great book for me. What lends itself to comedy is tragedy. The great comedies work not because you find a funny situation and work it, but because you find a situation that's not in the slightest bit funny and work it. You're finding comedy where comedy should not be. And to that degree, you're shedding a light that you don't expect to shed. I mean, comedy is a way of being intelligent about something. It's a way of enlivening a subject, and it's a way of bringing to bear all your thoughts. For me, therefore, comedy is the highest thing, and therefore no subject is, you know, not suitable for it.
Howard Jacobson, The Finkler Question is out from Bloomsbury. And now, back to those autobiographies. It'll come as no surprise to anyone to learn that Katie Price doesn't write her own bestsellers. But how deep does the ghostwriting rot go?
Well, that was the explicit theme of Roman Polanski's film The Ghost, which was based on Robert Harris's novel of the same name about political ghostwriting. And the book suggested, and the film suggested, that ghostwriters are employed for corrupt motives by those in power.
So we invited our very own Simon Hattonstone in to debunk some of the myths. He's a ghostwriter himself, and he explained to me, along with the critic and writer Peter Bradshaw, why ghostwriters aren't all down-at-heel hacks.
I'm really proud of my ghostwriting. I did two books, and they were at a very similar time. They were in parallel, and they were very different. One was the autobiography of the snooker player Ronnie O'Sullivan, and the other was the autobiography of Dwayne Brooks, who was the then boy who was attacked with Stephen Lawrence on the night that Stephen Lawrence was murdered and came in for an incredibly hard time from the establishment and suffered terrible post-traumatic stress. And I'm incredibly proud of that book. I'm incredibly proud of both books, actually, even though they're not my books.
Mm. Well, let's go back and actually break down a little bit what ghostwriting is, because it's actually a huge area, isn't it, Peter? I mean, it's something that stretches way back into history.
Yes, it does. As I understand it, the term arose because of wanting to give famous sports stars in the early 20s, the baseball star Babe Ruth and the tennis star Bill Tilden, had to produce books and syndicated newspaper columns for their armies of fans. And that kind of triggered a new ancillary industry of writers, journalists, and sort of humble kind of team players who would turn out pros. And the term was invented. They were their ghosts. There wasn't what we would think of now as the professionalism of the ghost, somebody who used this term. They talk it out of them. They listen to their tone of voice, and they replicate, like a kind of pub tribute band, they replicate that tone and churn it out to 60, 70, 80,000 words.
Mm. Simon, is that your experience of working with Ronnie O'Sullivan, since he fits into this tradition of sports ghosting, doesn't he?
I think it's different from how it was. In the old days, ghosts were genuine ghosts. They were invisible, weren't they? Whereas now we get a little credit and a little byline on it. I think what was very important in terms of Ronnie is someone who had an amazing story. He didn't have one story, he had loads of stories. He was like a snooker prodigy at 12. By 15, his dad was in prison for murder. By 16, his mum was in prison for tax evasion, and he was bringing up the family by himself. He had loads of depression. He was funny. He'd had a kind of hellish and heavenly life. And I think the skill in writing his book, for me, is telling his story in a way that sounds like him, but also sounds like a written book. So it's not exactly copying his voice, but it's getting part of his voice. Mm. But if you got it all, it wouldn't read like a book.
So it's really an extension of the big feature interview in a magazine, is it? It's like an extended feature interview.
I think that's why interviewers tend to be quite good at ghosting, because, weirdly or not, for journalists, it's about submerging ego. And to me, the best, what I love in an interview is when you capture someone's voice. You know, it's not what you say so much, it's when you can hear the person talking. And to do that, you kind of have to slightly forget about what you think about the person, and it's more about them telling their story. Mm. But of course, with interviews, you would interject and you would make points, whereas if it's Ronnie's story, I'm not there to judge Ronnie. Mm-hmm. And the great thing about Ronnie and Dwayne was that they both were addicted to the truth. They were both desperate to tell the truth.
Truth-telling there from Simon Haddonstone. Well, it takes a rather different tack for Edmond Duval, whose first venture into memoir pushed him right out of his comfort zone.
Yes, he's a ceramicist, or as he prefers to have it, a potter, and his book, The Hair with Amber Eyes, has been one of the real word-of-mouth hits of this year. It's subtitled A Hidden Inheritance, and the inheritance he's referring to was a collection of Japanese netsuki, which to you and me would be kimono toggles.
So we tracked Edmond down to his London studio to find out more about the extraordinary journey of discovery they led him on.
And so this is my book and pot room. I make pots downstairs, and then finished things come up here.
And it's rather a sort of Japanesey space.
It is, actually. It's very Japanese.
It's an unusual form of memoir. He uses the story of these tiny objects to explore the amazing history of his family across the 19th and 20th centuries. Do you actually keep your collection here, Edmund?
No, the collection is at home, but they're lovely tiny things and they slip into your pocket, so I do actually wander around London on and off with a netsuke in my pocket.
Can you explain to me exactly what a netsuke is?
Yes, it's Japanese. It's very small. It's a carving, either in wood or ivory or bone, and they were used as toggles for a pouch which hangs off your kimono sash. So you have to imagine a very small carving of any number of different plants or animals or people doing odd things, intricately and beautifully and lyrically carved, and you have it hanging there so you can actually handle it.
How did they come to be in your family, this collection?
I mean, I first found them, saw them, in my great-uncle's collection in Tokyo when I was there studying 30 years ago. And they were a collection that was originally put together in the 1870s in Paris by a great cousin called Charles Effrussi. He was a great aesthete and collector and writer about art, a man of extraordinary taste and extraordinary wealth. And he was a friend of the Impressionists and commissioned them. And
collected. He's actually in a Renoir picture.
He's in a Renoir picture.
It's the boating party.
The boating party. Mm. So he moved in these extraordinary circles, and there was this sort of passion for Japanese objects and Japanese paintings as well, and prints, and lacquer.
So this was just after the opening up of Japan?
Just after the opening up. And so they're part of that very specific moment. And so he's one of the sort of pioneer collectors.
The thing that really struck me about this book that seemed really unusual is the way you've constructed memoir through objects. So instead of taking a psychological approach, the psychology comes out of what you observe.
One of the extraordinary things about this sort of quest was to find out where they'd been and what they meant to all the people who've handled them over the last 150 years, which is a stupid thing to try and work out. I mean, why would you try and write a history of objects in that way? Really a history of touch, trying to find out what objects mean to people. The thread of how they lived with objects seemed to me a very real one. I mean, that's what I do for my living. I'm a potter, I care about objects. And I'd inherited this collection, which is about all about picking things up. Mm. And so I felt that that was a real way of connecting these people across the generation.
And then he gets bored of it.
He gets bored.
He's a man of fashion. He has to move.
He's absolutely a man of fashion. Things moved on. And he grew even grander. He moved to a wonderful, huge new house with his brother, who he lived with. And they didn't fit. And so when my great-grandfather, Victor, was getting married in 1899, his first cousin, his favourite first cousin, he sent us a wedding present, this huge vitrine, with these Netscapes. They arrive in this new place, the second resting place for this collection, just at the turn of the century, in this vast palace on the Ringstrasse, this Palais Uffizi, it was called.
So how did the Netscape fit in there? Because they're quite little things, aren't they? They're not grand.
They're not grand at all. And so it ends up in my great-grandmother Emmy's dressing room. And she was a great beauty and lived for...
Her lovers?
Her lovers, actually. Yes, she lived for her lovers. She lived for this extraordinary series of people in her life.
And then, of course, bringing us to the saddest part of the story.
The great moment of crisis, the moment when the fault line on which they are living finally cracks open, of course, is in 1938 at the Anschluss, when Austria is taken over, welcomes the Nazis in. Their house is broken into.
But the Netzke find their way back.
At the moment of the Anschluss, when the house is being taken apart, ripped apart, Anna, who's Gentile, my great-grandmother's maid, she takes the Netzke one by one and she hides them, and she hides them in her mattress. After the war, my grandmother goes back in 1945, and Vienna's in ruins, opens door and she goes in. There's a nice American there who says, well, I'm afraid you can see there's nothing really here, and there isn't. And there's Anna. Anna's in the house, and Anna says, I've got something to give back to you.
Ooh, that story gives me goosebumps every time I hear it. Edmund de Val's The Hare with Amber Eyes is published by Chatto and Windus.
Well, the goosebump moment for me this year, I think, was meeting Simon Armitage at the Hay Festival. He was armed there with a new poem from his collection, Seeing Stars.
There is a title poem in there in which somebody receives a very nasty blow on the head. And the seeing stars that he's talking about in that poem are those stars that circle around people's head, you know, when they're suffering from a kind of cartoon concussion, and usually with little canaries as well, I think. I suppose it's also a little bit of a reference to celebrity culture. The poems do nominate certain people, and because there's a sort of a sense of celebrity through some of the poems, I think there's a sense of absurdism.
One of the first things that is going to strike anyone who opens the collection is the way in which the poems are laid out, and the layout is very prose-like.
Yeah.
The lines sort of run on, and they take up quite a lot of the page, and they're all very similar in layout. Why did you choose to approach them that way?
In fact, I've published some of these poems in magazines in with different layouts, and it was only really when I got to the stage of putting together the proofs that me and my editor sat down and started looking at ways that they would appear on the page. And I suppose what I was after was some kind of... I wanted them to signal some kind of hybrid appearance between poetry and prose. They're not prose poems because I've edited the line endings. And I would still argue that they have that kind of italicized feeling that
so poetry. This is the question. Is it just chopped up prose? Is the question that people are bound to put about it? And so, what is it that makes it poetry in your view?
Because I say it is.
Oh.
But I would still maintain that the writing here is not information based, which is what prose tends to be, and that there are words and phrases that you can look at and accept that they've been chosen for qualities other than just, exposition.
Well, let's let our listeners judge for themselves. You're going to read to us from the collection a poem called Knowing What We Know Now.
Knowing What We Know Now. The elf said to Kevin, "You're probably wondering why I'm sitting here at your breakfast table this morning, helping myself to your condiments. Kevin, I'm here to make you a very special offer. Let's call it a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Today, you're 44 years and 36 days old, and that's exactly how long you've got left. Let me save you the mental arithmetic. You're going to live till you're 88 years and 72 days, and you've just crossed the halfway line. It's what we elves like to call the tipping point. So, Kevin, as of now, you can either carry on regardless and pretend we never met, or say the word, and I can flip the hourglass on its head. Do you see what I'm saying? So instead of getting older, you'll be heading back in the other direction. I've got all the forms. You just sign here, here, and here, and it's goodbye incontinence. Hello, Ibiza. What do you say, Kevin? The arthritis in Kevin's shoulder had been bothering him of late, and the prospect of revitalising his tired and aching joints was tantalising, to say the least. Imagine crusading once again through the unconquered landscapes of early manhood, knowing what he knew now. But what about Annie, the woman he loved, the only woman he'd loved in his whole life? Could he really go swanning around with a young man's intentions and a fashionable t-shirt while she slipped away towards undignified infirmity and toothless old age? How cowardly to let her walk death's shadowy footpath alone, thus betraying his every promise to her, thus breaking every vow. And an image formed in his mind, Annie with ghostly hair and faraway eyes, cradling him in her limp, skinny arms, roses in a vase on the bedside table next to the tissues and ventilator, his flawless cheek against her grey cotton gown, his tiny mouth moving hungrily towards her sunken breast. I won't do it, because of my Annie, said Kevin emphatically. The elf said, Kevin, you're a gentleman, and God knows there aren't many of them around. And your Annie, she's one in a million. He wiped a few crumbs of crisp bread from the corner of his mouth and added, no two ways about it. Had the pleasure of breakfasting with her just a few months ago, a stunning, captivating woman, and looking younger every day. Then with a shuffle of his silver slippers on the hardwood floor, he was gone.
Simon Armitage trying to find a new form for his work. Writers spend an awful lot of their time and energy trying to be original and fresh, but sometimes it turns out that even their best ideas have already been had before. Thus, the SF writer China Mieville, pioneer of the new weird, found eerie pre-echoes of his own cut-out world in the 1930s.
I grew up with sampling technology, as you know, all the music we were hearing was kind of cobbled together from these samples of other work. And I think that that kind of very, very respectful but rather piratical filching and sticking together is something that's quite important. So for me and a lot of other writers, so I certainly try and sort of put a lot of kind of references and nods, and sometimes teasing, sometimes respectful. But yeah, I like that sort of texture. This is all illustrations. This is Une Semaine de Bonté by Max Ernst, a surrealist novel in collage where he's taken lots and lots of images from things like Victorian etchings and a lot of catalogues, black and white catalogues from the late 19th century and early 20th century. And he's with extraordinary patience and skill kind of cut them up and pasted them together so that it tells a story in this wordless, very strange, very opaque way. The way he puts them together, you really can't, in many cases, see the join at all, so that you have this tale of, like, the sea and dragons and lions, and there's a whole section with birds where the what appears to be the protagonist keeps going from scene to scene with his head become a bird's head. And I always liked black and white art, crosshatched illustrations. And when I first kind of came across Max Ernst's work as a sort of young teenager, it was really a bomb going off in my head. And I love the fact that this does tell a story and that you can trace a narrative through it, but that, of course, it's always a very sort of ambiguous narrative. And yet somehow it still manages to be kind of exciting and strange. So in some ways it's a comic strip, in some ways it's a whodunit, although I kind of think of it more as a whodunwhat, really. So it's a very powerful work for me.
It doesn't have any words in it at all.
There are a few words, but the vast majority of it are these extraordinary, extraordinary images.
So now you say you discovered this as a teenager. That's a very extraordinary book to discover. How did you do so? You lived in Norfolk.
I think probably quite a lot of slightly nerdy, enthusiastic, fantastic influenced, geeky kids find the surrealists quite early. And you know, I used to go to the Tate a lot. This is Tate Britain, as is now, you know. And I remember, you know, being in my sort of mid-teens and going to exhibitions. And one of the first exhibitions that I went to that had a huge impact on me was this enormous Ernst exhibition. And, you know, these enormous decalcomania paintings he does where he smears paint with glass and all these things. And then in one room there were these these collages put together, and they were, you know, selling copies of the book. You can buy it reasonably cheap. It's nice reproductions. So it was just a nice piece of kind of parallel evolution, I think. It sort of slotted very nicely into a Max Ernst-shaped hole in my head.
Give us a flavour of it.
Well, this is the introduction to the second book, Monday, the element water. Example, water. What do you see? Water. What colour is this water? The colour of water.
China Mieville, talking on our series The Books That Made Me. And what a good year it's been. I hope for you too. Look out for our look ahead to 2011 on New Year's Eve. And until then, from me, Claire Armistead, from Sarah Crown, and from our producer, Tim Mabey. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.